Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Blizzard's Greatest Games podcast, brought to you by Outset Studios in bonnie South Wimbledon. I am Marcus Speller, and Jonathan Wilson, of course, is here, the man behind the Blizzard. And today joining us is Ian Hawkey. Now, in this podcast, we look back at some of the greatest games in the history of football, certainly some games that have caught the imagination and have an interesting story surrounding them, or backstory at least. So today, gentlemen, we're looking at the Copa del Rey final of 2004. Our guest Ian has chosen this game. Immediately, I think Beckham, Galacticos and whatnot. But Ian, why have you chosen this game?
It's partly that. It was an important episode in the story of Real Madrid at the beginning of this century, which was a big story, and Real Madrid projected it as a very big story. But this was... It was a fantastic game, which we'll get to, but it took place at a very emotionally charged time. The final was scheduled for 6 days after the Madrid bombings, which were obviously a terrible event for all of us anywhere in the world. And it certainly obviously affected the whole of Spain. And this was the cup final is a cup final like anywhere. It's a sort of national celebration event, and you could feel the tension, the release, the desire for a successful event after all the sadness. And it involved a team from the team that represents Madrid, you know, which was the city affected by this. It took place in Barcelona as well, which is always, there's always a little bit of tension around the Copa del Rey final if it's in Barcelona or involves Barcelona Club. This one didn't involve Barcelona Club, but it was taking place at the biggest, if you like, status symbol stadium in Catalonia, which is the Olympic Stadium. The king goes there, otherwise it wouldn't be the Copa del Rey, and sometimes the national anthem is booed if Barcelona are involved. So all these things key into the cup final. On this occasion, they didn't. There was, you know, this was more serious. Spain was in absolutely national mourning, and for Spain to do anything nationally is quite a big deal. So there was a march in Barcelona on the Saturday in to express unity with Madrid, which was its own powerful statement.
I mean, where would Zaragoza fit in that sort of internal dynamic of Spain?
That's a good question. Fiercely proud of being from Aragon, so very much like most regions of Spain, proud of their own identity, but not ostentatiously anti-central in the way that, say, Bilbao or Barcelona is. And clearly this was a big occasion for them. Lots of Aragonés flags in the stadium and so on. And Real Madrid represent for them, like anyone else from the regions, you know, a powerful enemy in which you take up a sort of underdog position, and it's all the better you can pull something off.
Yeah, and as an Englishman, one can, you know, forget the politics and whatnot of Spain, but of course, when you say that, it all comes back to memory. But also, Jonathan, as Ian's saying, in the context of the Madrid bombings and so on, amazing sort of, I suppose, significance or the eyes of the whole country, maybe even much wider in Europe and the world, were on this final.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see that fairly frequently after you have terror attacks or natural disasters that you used the word release. And I think, yeah, certainly I remember being in Angola after the terror attack on the Togo team, and that Angola-Mali game, the opening game of that Cup of Nations in 2010, which would have been 4 days after the attack, I think. And just the fact that that went off without a hitch was such a relief to everybody there. And so I think that's where you know, it's very easy to talk about the symbolic role of sport. But I think something like this, it actually has a role that's more than symbolism. It shows that kind of things are still functioning. The country is still working, and people are still able to put on an event together.
Yeah, and that what you said earlier there, Ian, about the statement of in Barcelona having a march in solidarity in Madrid, that's huge, isn't it? Really,
absolutely, it was. It was a very, very powerful event. That my own experience of this was, I'd been at Real Madrid against Bayern Munich on the previous Wednesday night. They'd They'd won. They'd played very well. And I had my, I was living in Barcelona.
And that was what, last 16 of a
Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah. I had a train back to Barcelona the next morning. I was running a little bit late. I was running towards Atocha station for the train. A policeman tried to hold me up. I didn't know what was going on. I got a little bit shirty. And then I realised why the policeman was holding me up.
Yes, of
because
course.
Several trains coming in and out of the station had been bombed. And
my goodness. So that was the kind of background, really, for this game, which was quite an extraordinary final. But, of course, the other, you know, if we're concentrating on the football, this was a Real Madrid side, and we know the pomp and facade of Real Madrid and the grandeur and the splendour of them. But this was them in full flow, really. The Galacticos, the big names coming in, as I say, Beckham was there and so on. And this was a team who were playing wonderful football, certainly for the first half of that season in Beckham's first year there.
Yeah, absolutely. They were. I mean, it was a big cup final globally anyway, because this was Real Madrid in their absolute superstar concentration. So I'll just give you the midfield. So we had Beckham, Figo, Zidane. Okay, we had Raul up front. There were two conspicuous absentees, I would say, which I think will have a bearing on this. Ronaldo, that's Ronaldo Phenomenal, that's you know, Brazil's Ronaldo. He was injured. And
he was sat in the stand, wasn't he? Was
that's
there,
right. But... Yes, he was sitting there in the stand. Showing his, you know, unity on this big occasion. And Casillas, because it was a cup game, gave way. Cesar Sanchez, who was a distinguished Spain international, got the cup games in goal. So I've given you the front five or six of the team. Let's look at the
Solari as well. Santi Solari.
Yeah, Santi Solari came in for Ronaldo. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you the players behind them, and then I'll ask you to play spot the central defender. So we have Michel Salgado, Raul Bravo, Ivan Helguera, Roberto Carlos, and Guti.
Yeah.
So. Well, there's two centre-backs there, but there's not much of a central midfield there.
I mean, I'll pin the tail on Ivan Helguera.
Yes, who, if he walked in here now, would tell you at great length, I'm a midfield player, please.
I'm sure we would nod along.
Yeah.
And how would Raul Bravo see himself?
As
a footballer?
Yeah, yeah. Very fortunate to be there, quite frankly.
Yes. He was looking forward to the peak of his career with Leeds United.
And Salgado at Blackburn Rovers, presumably.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So Salgado, at least you could say this is a defender.
Sure.
Well, he put in a proper defender's challenge early on, didn't he? A really kind of horrendous tackle. Yeah.
But, I mean, you're right. That the midfield, and obviously Ronaldo wasn't playing, he was in the stands. Just it was something else as a fan to see those players all assemble. I mean, it was like an Avengers assemble, wasn't it, really, all in there. But they lost the game.
Yes. And you know, there was some great football for Real Madrid. Mm-hmm. There really was. They started in command, as you'd anticipate. And you know, they knew how to make the best in phases of what, you know, slightly unbalanced look. So Beckham was a central midfielder because Figo was obviously outside right. Guti was the deepest midfielder. Now Guti is a number 10, you know, certainly. But he was, you know, he had to fit in. He was a sub Galactico, so he got told what to do.
He was never thought of playing Cambiaso.
Cambiaso that season was a bit of a...
Because obviously Makalele's left.
Yes. The background to the assembly of this sort of peak Galactico is Claude Makalele leaving in a huff at the beginning of in the summer once Beckham's arrived, and some fairly well-reported stories about Beckham's salary have been spread around the rest of the squad.
But there was that quote from Zidane about, you know, Perez has, was he bought the Rolls Royce or the BMW, something like that, but sold the engine. In Makalele, and they did look bereft of, you know, not even Thomas Gravesen could later come along and
well,
sort
yeah,
it out.
Yes, well, there are all sorts of attempted solutions in the later stages of the make do and mend for the Galactico product.
Yeah, but going back to the game, I remember Beckham got it underway with that wonderful free kick.
El hombre que casi le falta talonar, ahí está el inglés, chuta Beckham, gol.
Yeah, it was like 24 minutes. But I mean, it's a genuinely brilliant free kick.
Yeah.
I still wonder, and I sort of blame myself for this as well. I kind of think, I didn't quite appreciate what a good footballer Beckham was. All the other stuff got in the way.
Yeah.
But that free kick, he's what, 30 yards out?
Mm.
Maybe 28 or something, but it's definitely more than 25.
Yeah.
He hits it really hard and hits the inside the post on the way in.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a genuinely brilliant goal.
Yeah. Beckham could, and you need to be in a way quite robotic about free kicks when it's your specialism, but he did something different. I mean, the distance was very ambitious, and he really ran into that, you know, and he really thumped it and kept all his other skills, you know, the torque, the curve.
I mean, this almost seems a ridiculous question. Do you think he had any sort of status anxiety in that side? Was there any kind of imposter syndrome with him?
He's a fairly self-confident guy, but he's also, he was a realist that there was stuff that the others could do on the ball, which he's never going to be able to do. There was an anecdotal story, which I think I've heard it from enough sources, that they were doing something in the dressing room, perhaps from a magazine or a television programme, something about, your favourite goals. And, Ronaldo described some slalom from his own half, and, you know, Zidane, there was some pirouette before he puts the ball in or something.
Yeah.
And Beckham, you know, very candidly described a free kick to which apparently the South Americans above all looked at him askance. That's not a goal. That's sort of cheating.
Yes, isn't it? Yeah. I thought you were going to say the halfway line goal against Neil Sullivan. You know.
But, I mean, you look at that side, there's plenty of people who can take free kicks in that team.
Well,
Zidane, Figo, Roberto Carlos.
I mean, you talked about status. I think this was obviously a nice story for us. When he first arrived, you know, is he going to go to the front of this queue? And he did. And by this stage, this is March, this final, he hadn't scored from a direct free kick at that stage. So
that was his first free kick?
Big showpiece thing. There was impatience. People were talking about it. Maybe Roberto Carlos should get a few more goals, although at that stage, Roberto Carlos's hit rate was dubious. Maybe Figo would certainly have thought of himself that he should get more goals. The funny one about this, Zidane was really, really good at these. And I think possibly because he wasn't quite so pushy in the training ground, or certainly on the pitch, probably got fewer chances.
I mean, 3 months later, he'd score that free kick against England.
Absolutely. So, yes, France recognised.
Yeah.
But the names in that team are extraordinary. I remember seeing a little cartoon strip in an English newspaper or something around that time, and it was, Ronaldo, Figo, Zidane, you know, the names just roll off the tongue, all gathered around and looking at Beckham saying, oh, what's Phil Neville like, you know? And when Beckham went there, I know we've mentioned Beckham a lot, but again, being Englishman, that's only natural, I suppose. But to kind of go into that team and the football they were playing, you know, Beckham talks about this in his autobiography, that the football they play for that kind of first half of the season or for 7-8 months, however long it sort of went on, was quite incredible. But they did run out of steam. And was this, I can't remember, and you'll remember better than me, was the cup final the moment where they did, or was it?
I think it was a very conspicuous turning point. Absolutely, right. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So 5 minutes after Beckham's put them ahead, Zaragoza equalise.
Yeah.
So,
I should say.
Yeah, Savio.
That's right.
Gets the ball down the left, chips the ball at the back post. And Danny lashes it in.
Yeah, two former Madrid players, incidentally. I mean, there's a lot of former Madrid players about, but Savio had been, you know, quite a high status player and possibly edged out in the whole Galactico thing. And it's poor defending, it's poor marking, it's an absence of a centre half. Solari is back there.
Well, and equally, I wonder if Roberto Carlos should have been picking up at the back post.
But it's
a collapse.
I'm not sure if that was in his job description, but.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, whose job description was it? That was the problem, wasn't it?
This is, you know, Raul Bravo, a converted fullback, not very experienced, and Helguera miffed at being moved from central midfield, which he was very good at. He was a good centre-half as well, but it was an emergency square peg solution, really.
Yeah.
So then Beckham hits the post with another free kick. Then just before half-time, Guti gets the wrong side of David Villa, brings him down, penalty. Yeah. David Villa scores the penalty, and Zaragoza are 2-1 up at half time. And I guess to us now, the idea of Zaragoza being 2-1 up against Real Madrid in a cup final seems absurd. But they had won the cup 3 years before, and they'd won another cup within the decade, hadn't they? So this was their third in a decade.
Yes. And actually, within Within a decade, they'd also been won the European Cup Winners' Cup.
They're a good cup side. Whereas Real Madrid hadn't won it in 11 years.
Yes, yeah. In a way, I think you can look back and say that this Copa del Rey, because it was a Galactico showpiece, I think changed the Copa del Rey a little bit. It was broadcast worldwide because it had Zidane, Figo, Beckham, etc. And I think almost from that stage, the big boys in Spain started perhaps taking it a bit more seriously. There was a phase, I think, in the 90s where it was a little bit Carling Cup for Madrid and Barcelona.
I watched the highlights again this morning to refresh myself, and it was an American program I was watching the highlights from, and their whole thing was Real Madrid trying to win the first treble in their history. And you sort of think, we sort of think of trebles as being a thing teams aim for now. But maybe this was the first time when you start to get the emergence of super clubs where that was actually a genuine thing you could do.
And I suppose for the club really trying to establish itself as a world power, if you know what I mean. Because I suppose in the 90s, you said some sides had a global reach, but suddenly the internet's in everyone's house and whatnot.
Well, I think that's an important point, that kind of the nature of media changes. Absolutely. which creates the environment which these super clubs can be super, more super than they had been before.
And the super club wants to win absolutely everything.
And treble is a resonant thing now. It's a marketing object. Treble.
Absolutely right.
Then 2 minutes after half time, another free kick for Real Madrid. Roberto Carlos manages to miss the wall at last, pings it in the bottom corner. Keeper's maybe slightly slow to move, but possibly unsighted. I mean, we were just saying before we began, if I believed Roberto Carlos had seen the space and drilled the ball there deliberately, then it's a brilliant goal.
It's a tricky
My suspicion is Roberto Carlos just hit the ball really hard somewhere towards the goal, and this time it found the gap and went in.
And a few handfuls of times it worked throughout his career. But it's a tricky one, though. If you're a goalkeeper facing a Real Madrid free kick, you're thinking,
many options.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Where do you stand? Where do you stand? You know? So you can understand if it might be a touch harsh on the keeper to say. Yeah.
And these two actually, they did have some rituals. You know, Roberto Carlos was often there looming. You tend to think sometimes, well, is this something they've spoken about earlier? Or actually, are they arguing with each other who's going to get there first? Which that certainly has happened in some cases. It's interesting to listen to us talk. We trust David, don't we? David, that all his free kicks were perfectly planned. And we think Roberto Carlos, he was a bit lucky there. That's the Beckham brand for you.
Yeah, but there's a difference in how they take them. The Beckham was sort of clipping them. He had that very robotic, regimented technique, a sort of Johnny Wilkinson-style technique. Whereas Roberto Carlos, he admits himself, the famous goal in the tournoi was a fluke. And for all he talked immediately afterwards about, I set the valve in the right place. It was all nonsense. He just kicked it really hard. It's quite an aggressive game. A lot of tackles. Yeah, yeah. 16 yellow cards in the game. Eventually, both teams get a man sent off.
Cani goes after just shortly after the hour.
67, and then Guti goes 5 minutes into extra time.
So you've got half an hour of Zaragoza down to 10 men against the Galacticos of Real Madrid. So what's going to happen?
Well, watching him back, I was so surprised because the Roberto Carlos goal goes in, as you say, sending off, and you think, okay, the picture is going to become the one that we all thought would play out here, and of course it didn't.
And I think you suddenly start to see Madrid looking really very tired against 10 men, and that's where I just think this was a turning point.
There's an interesting thing there as well, that Chiara's only used one substitute.
Yes, absolutely.
He brought on Portillo for Solari, but the Galacticos are untouchable. You can't take them off.
There is that, and we certainly know that exists. But I think there's also Quiroz saying, I've looked at my squad, I've looked at my bench, and I'm sorry, tired old Lewis, you're going to have to carry on.
But I suppose
once you've lost Guti, you bring Cambiaso on to shore up the midfield.
The Cambiaso's status that season was very low, and I've never really understood why. He had a little bit of a phase at the beginning of the season where he was considered the next best to Makalele, but for some reason, I'm sure other people would know better, he just didn't seem to
to fit in with that. And then just to finish off what happens in the game, 8 minutes from time, so 112 minutes. One of Savagosa's substitutes, Luciano Galletti, hits this sort of slightly odd sort of clipped curling shot from just outside the box. It sort of bounces over Cesar Sanchez's hand.
Yes, and it's
the bounce that beats him, isn't it?
The bounce that beats him. Now, there's a story there as well. They were using the new Adidas ball, which was because it was a federation event, which had just been launched in ahead of the European Championships that summer. So there was an awful lot of talk about this. By an amazing coincidence, David Beckham, sponsored by Adidas, thought this ball was absolutely terrific.
Well, in fairness, his free kick
gets in there. But so you've got three goals where the new ball is scrutinised. You know, the two free kicks and the Galletti shot, which does bounce, seems to have a bit of a kick on it, doesn't it?
I mean, he hits it in a way that the bounce is not not ridiculous. You know.
No, it's not freakish, but it's pronounced, isn't it?
And that won the game, and I find it incredible. We were just saying moments earlier that Real Madrid, it was so much emphasis on attacking. It was all just we will outgun them, we will outscore them. But it was more reckless, as you say, when you describe that back line and not having going for the option of Cambiasso. Did this result? Did it begin to change that? Because from the outside, I don't remember it having that effect, really.
Well, it took a long time. I remember during that game noticing that Guti was losing his temper. Now, Guti was quite a fiery player, very, very talented player. But he was losing his temper. He was being asked to be Claude Makélélé when really he wanted to be Zinedine Zidane. And he kept being the last line of defence. And he was losing his temper even before he got his second yellow card, and that was the time afterwards that people said, well, why didn't you take him off? He was getting ratty. He was getting tired. They were all really tired, and Queiroz said in his slightly inscrutable and diplomatic way, he did say that he wasn't clear about what alternatives there were. In other words, the squad was too shallow.
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan, from a tactical point of view, does it want to make you tear your hair out?
Well, I just think that whole season it's a very odd mix. So Queiroz is a coach who pretty much everywhere else he's been, his football has been uber cautious. Mm. It's all been about whole possession. Don't risk losing the ball. You know, he was very successful with Iran doing that. Mm-hmm. You're playing possession football with Iran, even against teams from other confederations. Portugal the same, is South Africa team the same? You know, that's the way he plays football. I think it's a very Portuguese people of his generation recognise that as a way of playing. You know, his youth teams of the late 80s, early 90s, they didn't quite score as many goals as their talent suggests they should, and that was always Portugal's problem. And you know, everybody sort of said, oh, it's because they don't have a centre forward; they're relying on Pauleta. Well, it's also just the way Queiroz plays football. Mm-hmm. And so to take that very risk-averse style manager and give him the Galacticos, in one way, you think that's actually a brilliant fit because he's somebody who can defend without needing classical defensive players. He can defend through possession. But on the other hand, he is somebody who applies a straitjacket that I think the vast majority of those Galacticos would not find comfortable.
There was a tendency in that Madrid as well, so again slightly counterintuitively, that when they got into trouble, there were two people who could rescue them. Neither of those two were here for that fine. The Beckham long ball or the Zidane long ball to Ronaldo, that was a winner, and that was nothing to do with possession. That was straightforward. And Casillas really was miraculous in that era.
Yeah, one can forget what an amazing goalkeeper was over the years. So the slightly wider context, we touched upon it earlier, and you felt this was the turning point of the season for Real Madrid, this game. You know, when a barn burner of a game it was, but it changed the season because, as we say, Real Madrid, they were top of the league, they were playing superbly.
4 points clear at the top of the league as well.
And they finished fourth, wasn't it?
They finished fourth. They lost.
It was remarkable, really.
Their last five games of the season, in which, almost as if it was scripted, a Galactico was sent off in each every single one. Figo was sent off against Barcelona, which I think everyone had been seeing coming for about 3 years. Zidane was sent off, I think, at Depor. Mm-hmm. Beckham was sent off at Murcia. You were rubbish. For swearing at the linesman. Oh, so in a sense, as David often did, he got some credit out of it because he'd been criticised for not speaking Spanish very well.
Lo siento para español, pero no es mal, eh?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, Figo in Barcelona makes sense. Zidane, we know he liked a red card. And young David probably just thought, well, it seems to be the thing to do at the moment, you know, and tried to integrate himself.
But what it was, you know, they were really frustrated and they were running out of gas. And in the meantime, having knocked Bayern Munich out of the Champions League, which is a feather in anyone's cap, they lost to Monaco, who, as we know, went on to reach the final. So the trophies were disappearing. They were running out of gas. And the model wasn't working. They played a lot of games. And that's the other thing about the Copa del Rey being sort of squeezed into the first 6 months of the season. They had a heavy fixture list and they didn't have the chance to rotate. And if there was a key difference between them and Valencia that year under mathematical Rafa Benitez with his rotations, you know, he paced everything superbly to stalk them at the end of the season.
Yeah, and how is that Real Madrid side looked upon now? Because we still can get a bit sort of starry-eyed with, as you say, you mentioned that midfield and so on, and it took Beckham, was it his final game in his third and
that's
last
right.
season
yes,
to
yeah.
win his only major
yes,
trophy.
That's right.
But then that was a slightly odd title anyway, because given they'd pretty much lost it by Christmas, hadn't they? And then they kind of
yes,
it
and it was a cliffhanger at the end.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was heroic in a way, but it was ragtag. It was Ruud van Nistelrooy.
Yep.
Just pressing and pressing and pressing till the end of the season. David Beckham coming back from total obscurity. Fabio Capello sometimes lining up the three central midfielders who would be the very un-Galactico. Two Diarras, Lassana and Mamadou, and I forget, anyway, somebody else who very
Guti
workmanlike.
Still? Or?
No, far too fancy.
Yeah. So how is that Madrid side looked upon now? Do people remember them at all?
I mean, clearly there's reverence, obviously, mm-hmm. for Zidane, you know, because of what has happened in the next Real Madrid chapter mm-hmm. of his career. Beckham is remembered genuinely fondly because there was an appreciation that he was a hard worker. There was even some sympathy with him when there was a row with Capello. Capello marginalised him, and the president at the time said he's a half-baked actor.
Oh, right.
Which was not a reference, I think, to diving. It was to do with this whole Hollywood.
Sure.
I'm not sure how fondly remembered Figo is. He had some great moments, Figo, but he was always the ex-Barcelona player, and I'm not sure if he quite had a defining season or game that made him.
And was there also? I mean, he didn't really hide very well the fact he never wanted to leave Barcelona.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
So that presumably kind of affected his.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, yeah. He didn't make the right declaration saying this is what I've always wanted. Really, I was just masquerading and.
He sort of ostracised himself from the Barcelona fans, and then to perhaps a lesser extent, maybe the Real Madrid fans. You know,
I sort of wonder, looking back at that, given Makelele was so good at what he did, you almost think they didn't just need one player in that role; they needed two. And Makelele could effectively be two players in the same way that N'Golo Kanté effectively is two holding midfielders because he so reads the game so well, is so quick, his stamina is so high. But I mean, do you think if Makelele had been there rather than Guti, would that team have won things? Do you think?
I think they might not have lost that final. I mean, you know, yes, I do, because you know all the evidence was that before phase two Galactico, as it were, Beckham and Ronaldo, you know, that they were the European champions, and it was working, and you know, Raul. Raul dipped a little bit actually when Ronaldo came, a change of roles and so on. Yeah, absolutely. I think there was, or even if you'd been able to get Helguera Makelele, that would have been a really
at the back of
and was a very effective doble pivot, as they say.
And I mean, when results started to go against them, did people blame the Galacticos philosophy, or did they blame the individuals, or did they blame Queiroz, or who was scapegoated for it?
There was some criticism of the president, Florentino Perez, who, you know, very much put his name and his money to...
And he left when?
He then resigned for the first time in 2006 and was coruscating about the spoiltness of the players, the entitlement, we call them indolent. But, you know, the system had rather indulged some of them. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he came back with not entirely reformed instincts about how to build a team and what the priorities were.
But do you, I mean, is there something about Real Madrid that sort of encourages that? The fact that they, you know, they're the most famous team of the late 50s of Di Stefano and Puskas and Paco Gento and Ramon Coppa. The fact that, yeah, they were Galacticos before the term was invented. Does that sort of condition the club to thinking that's how you do it, that's how you dominate Europe?
Absolutely, and especially the Florentino era, absolutely. This, you know, this collection on an annual basis of the best there is and put them together and see what happens. And the subordinating of the role of the coach, you know, whose task is really to arrange these counters as best he can, and then leave it to them. And I think Di Stefano has something to do with this. You had an absolutely dominant individual player who wanted to take command and believed in individual talent, and also would have regarded himself as obliged to sort things out when they went wrong on the pitch, and took orders very reluctantly from a coach.
And I mean, how different do you think the situation is now to that of 2004? I mean, my sort of feeling of it is that the Champions League, it sounds ridiculous to say if a team has won four Champions Leagues in 5 years, but that's kind of papered over the cracks. They've won two league titles in 11 years, which is their worst run since they first, you know, since they first won a title under Bernabeu's presidency in 53. So it feels to me as if all those old problems are still there. They haven't learned any, or Perez particularly has not learned any lessons, but they've got lucky at the right moments, or players have produced great moments at the right moments, or opposing goalkeepers done stupid things at key moments. And so they've won all these Champions Leagues slightly freakishly, but actually all these problems of 15 years ago are still there.
Absolutely. One player in particular has seen them through in those, you know.
Ramos or Ronaldo?
Well, Ramos is a good point, actually, because they do have that very combative centre-half that was missing in that first Galactico. It was missing since Hierro, basically. Yeah. And that has been important. I mean, and for all his ills, he has been a superb leader for Real Madrid.
The Spanish John Terry?
I think he's a more talented player.
Very diplomatically put, yeah.
In a popularity contest, yeah. And you know, Ronaldo has sorted things out. But they are, as you say, they have been very much a knockout team in that era. They haven't had the stamina to sustain doubles, to compete with Barcelona for most of those the last decade.
Well, I know Barcelona team who seem to have been quite grumpy with themselves for 4 or 5 years. They don't feel comfortable in what they're doing, Barcelona. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And you still get these conundrums. I mean, poor old Rafa Benitez, 3-4 years ago, had this same problem that he was reluctant to field a defensive midfielder. Toni Kroos can do it, can't he?
Yeah.
Luka can do it. Mm. They can do it better with Casemiro, but.
Jose Mourinho didn't struggle to play a more defensive minded
game.
No,
he didn't. No, but I think the conditions for him being allowed to do that, despite, you know, as well as his own dogmas and status and
of course
capacity to argue, were laid by the failure of Galactico 1, I think.
Yeah, incredible. It's never boring at Real Madrid, something we can all agree, gentlemen. Well, that brings us to the end of this podcast, but thank you very much, Ian. Amazing to talk about a game that one can easily forget, you know, so many finals and whatnot, but yeah, great to go over that one again. But thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to the Blizzard's Greatest Games podcast, brought to you by Outset Studios in South Wimbledon. We'll be back again with another game from the history of football. Thank you, Jonathan, and we'll see you next time.